Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I've skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. As a full moon rises over the quaint Major Spoilers HQ, a howl is heard in the distance. Only the bravest of souls leave the comfort of their seats to go investigate what it could be. Venture with the foolish travelers as they ignore sound advice and go off the road and discuss an American werewolf in London. How?
What do you know, Zach? Just in time for the end of All Hallows Eve.
Yeah. What a quinkadink.
Yeah.
Almost like it was planned.
Nah, I doubt it.
This is why you need to follow... This is why you need to follow instructions, Zach.
Yeah.
If someone tells you, stay on the road, don't venture off into the moors,
yes,
you need to follow instructions.
Absolutely.
And if we're looking at something that shows how Americans don't follow instructions, American Werewolf in London, Rodrigo, is that movie.
That's right. American Werewolf in London, a huge indictment of American tourists.
Oh, just terrible people.
Is what it is.
They bust in asking for food in the middle of the night. Yeah. Hey, give me some food.
They ask you what your pentagram is for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They expect to sleep with your nurses.
Yeah.
I like your pentagram or something.
So, Zach, give us a breakdown of this story.
Yes. So, we kind of covered the first part. David and his friend, Jack. Jack? Yep. I knew it was a J. Something like that. Are two Americans who decide to go... what I believe is backpacking through Europe. And they take a ride from a sheep man, get stuck in a town, and they figure out very quickly...
He grew up in the country, but not on a farm.
Yeah. A herder, if you will, maybe. They find out they're not welcome in this tavern, and they strike off, but they're told, stay on the road, don't go in the moors, beware of the moon, or something like that. They ignore this. A werewolf attacks, kills Jack, maims David, and he is in a coma for a while, eventually turns into a werewolf, terrorizes London. Thus, the title, An American Werewolf in London.
Pretty much it. I mean, a horror story. The interesting thing about the horror genre is it kind of goes in cycles. So in the early days of horror, you had some of the... trip to the moon type stuff wouldn't necessarily call it horror, even though it has, you know, like demons and things popping around and some of the malaise work. But, it's Universal Studios really got their start in, I mean, they were a lower rung movie production company back in the early days of Hollywood. I mean, I think RCA was ranked higher than Universal was. And they latched onto the horror genre. And, of course, you had The Phantom, which was a silent movie. Then you started to have movies like Frankenstein, Dracula.
The Mummy.
The Mummy. The Wolfman, right? And that really took Universal to a whole other level as this monster movie company elevated the Universal monsters that we know of them today, even though they're just all public domain characters from long-dead authors, into this stratosphere of what you can do with it. Unfortunately, what happens a lot of times with a genre is eventually it all will devolve into parody. And so you have Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, Abbott and Costello meet the Wolfman, or you have Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and you have all of these kinds of things. And even Bride of Frankenstein is almost a parody or almost a comedy to an extent. And so then the monster genre waned for a while, and then it started to come back in... the late 50s, really the late 50s with the B-movie horror stuff, you know, these ants from outer space killing people and the invaders from Mars, invasion of the body snatchers, and you have some real horror that comes
pod
in,
people.
Pod people. You know, that then that wanes. And then in the late 70s, early 80s, we start to see the resurrection of the horror genre once more with movies like Friday the 13th, with movies like The Shining, with movies like... An American Werewolf in London that really try to recapture audiences' enjoyment of being scared to death. And of course, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies start to get a little bit too crazy. You know, you get out there into the Dream Warrior land and people are just kind of give up on the genre, although we could talk splatter films another time. Then the genre resurrects itself once more in the late 90s with a lot of the torture porn stuff that came out.
Plus the later on with the return of the zombie movie.
Right,
too.
And the zombies as well. But it seems like the latest...
That early 90s, that whole Scream thing, wasn't that like...
Yeah, Scream was kind of being self-referential, mocking itself, coming around. But that did lead into the torture porn stuff like Saw and Hostel. And I forget, what's the other one that's just more recent? Centipede.
Human Centipede.
Human Centipede.
Yeah, House of Thousand Corpses.
You know, those kinds of things. House of a Thousand Corpses. So
there is no movie called The Human Centipede.
We see the ebb and flow of horror movies all the time. The interesting thing about The American Werewolf in London is it smacks right in the middle of the 80s horror, and it does it in a way to where it treats the horror as both horrific, because we'll get into the Baker makeup in just a little bit, Rick Baker, but it also adds a huge element of humor into the horror.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen interviews with John Landis, who
You know who John Landis is, right?
I mean, Lampoon.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off,
right?
Yeah,
Animal House.
Yep.
So where he's trying to get the movie made, and they won't because they're like, it's too funny to be a horror movie,
right.
And it's too scary to be a comedy,
right?
Yeah.
So finally, he goes in and he gets it made, it turns out to, you know, be both at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's one of the first like successful horror comedies.
And Matthew had mentioned, you know, the Scream series. Scream was very much that way as
Scream
well.
Scream is that way. Shaun of the Dead, which I think probably leans a little harder on comedy, but has like really horrific moments in it well.
Yeah. Somebody's guts being ripped out.
Exactly. Some really hard, like scary starts in that. And really what American Werewolf in London does successfully with the humor is that it removes a lot of your horror movie expectations. You know, you expect to be in this like spooky house and for the monster to be somewhere in there, but that doesn't happen in this. I mean, it happens at the very beginning,
right?
But the fact that everything's funny, the fact that the guy that warns you that something bad's going to happen is decaying in front of your eyes, also has a better, very matter of fact attitude about it. Like it just kills any expectation that you have to encounter a trope that you already know, and it like it allows you to be scared without expecting it.
Right. Yeah. And I think what works about the Jack the Dead Friend moments is, as you said, we get to see him decay the multiple times that he pops up, but he is very matter of fact. As you got to kill yourself, man. You got to kill yourself and keep me from wandering the earth. And oh, by the way, here are the six people you killed last night. Susie and her boyfriend, Tom. Hello. How are you? Please use a gun, kill yourself. You know, it's just that, wow, really? Right. That's really well put together in those parts. And I think that there was another bit that I found extremely fun. Oh, the dream sequence that he has when he's in the coma of Nazi werewolves coming in and murdering his family.
Right.
I think you really nailed it on, because my defense, I'm not one that likes horror movies that much. I don't like, I'm out of that moment of my life where I like that thrill of being scared. And so my defense, if I have to watch one, is trying to make it funny and make myself laugh. So I remove the horror from it. But this movie meets you at that and says, no, it's like, we're going to do it for you.
Right.
And so we're making you laugh, and then we're just going to terrify you.
It takes that power away from you.
Yeah. You can't.
Yeah. Matthew, why do we like to be scared?
Well, I think it ties into a very visceral moment. I mean, there are times when I'll be in my living room and something will seem to move.
Is it Slender
Man? I'm a grown man, partially educated.
Is it a spider?
I know what's in this house. I put it in this house. But when something seems to move, my immediate thought is gremlins or monsters or, you know, giant things from beyond the pale coming to kill me. There's an excitement. It gets your blood racing. In a way, it's kind of the same response you have to like a really good first kiss. Your heart starts to pound and you start to sweat, and, you know, things start to fall off. I don't know. I'm not normal. But I think that when you get to a point where the humor, that ha ha ha, I'm laughing so hard it hurts, and the terror, the leaping around and feeling like your whole body is tense, when that's together, it's even more visceral. It's even more terrifying because you're not expecting it. You're not sitting there like in Paranormal Activity waiting for the next jump scare. You're laughing at the sheep, and then all of a sudden, oh yeah, terrible, horrible death. Or, you know, you laugh at him calling Jack a meatloaf, and then you realize, oh, by the way, that's disgusting. This guy's melting.
Yeah, I think part of the reason why we like to be scared is a biological reaction, because when we are startled, when we are scared, when the alien jumps out of some guy's chest, or when the cat comes back and it's got a hand in its mouth, or when Christine starts to uncrumple, or in this case, when the Nazi werewolves break into the house, we have that fight or flight response, right? That releases all these endorphins rushing into our body. And suddenly, when that moment wears off, we're filled with all of this adrenaline and endorphins, and we just start giggling and laughing, and a lot of rush.
And a lot of people think that the rush of, like, the reason why horror movies are pleasurable, really, is that the moment immediately after, because, you know, danger gets our blood pumping and pours all this adrenaline into our bodies, but if you've ever been in actual danger, if you've ever had like your car like spin out on the highway or something, the moment afterward,
you're laughing like a loon.
Yeah. When you get that wave of relief that you didn't die, is it's euphoria.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. Yeah. So that's what a horror movie does for us. It like, it knocks you there. And then when you come back down from it, it just like floods your body with that feeling.
So what are some traditional tropes that we see in a horror movie, horror monster movie? First of all, maybe do we need to explain what a trope is? Zach, do you know what a trope is?
Like a reoccurring thingy that genres will use.
Yep. A trope is a technique or a theme or something that you can recognize in multiple media, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And when you're looking at horror, the horror genre itself, you know, the Western, good guys wear white, guys wear black, that kind of stuff. Right. But in horror, there are some very specific tropes that are used that are signals that something is about to happen. Musical cues, for example, are a good example. Mm-hmm. Framing where you're not giving a lot of look space to your character, everything is behind. And then, of course, a lot of the corniness that can kind of come in, that's really spelled out a lot in Scream. By the time you figure out this formula, like, okay, if you're having sex, you're going to die. Mm. If you're a virgin, you're going to live. If you are this, this is going to happen, and so on and so forth. And these kinds of things, I think, still work really, really well, even though 60, 70 years, 100 years later, in most of these monster movie cases, we know what they are and we know what's coming up. Right?
Right.
Matthew, what are some of those other tropes then of the horror genre?
Well, I mean, the ones that really pop to mind for me are what I refer to as the jump scare, or the cat through the window, where they build the tension and you feel the music and something is about to happen and it's nothing. Or if you get into specifically the 80s slasher genre, you get to that point where, oh, I'm so glad he's dead. He's clearly not dead. And he rises up behind you and you don't see it and he comes to kill you. I mean, there are hundreds of things that you'll see popping up again and again and again. Specifically, if you go back to the really, really old, like the monster movies before Abbott and Costello met Frankenstein, those are all about the music making you nervous.
Right.
And then dun, dun, dun. So, I mean, that's just what pops right off the top of my head.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, horror comes from our fear of the unknown in a lot of ways. So everything's always going to be very dark, but although not as dark as what Zach watched, apparently. and we'll get into that maybe a little bit later.
In a bit.
So, you know, it's not a coincidence that monsters come out at night or live in caves or hang out in the dark part of your spaceship. Like, there's a reason, and that's so that they can jump out and kill you.
Right.
And that's, I mean, it seems obvious, but that in and of itself is a trope, that the monster is in the darkness. Now, An American Werewolf in London, and a lot of werewolf movies and werewolf stories, and I think the good werewolf stories play with another trope, which is you are the monster. What do you do? Right. And it puts the character in a decision of when, like, you are moving towards this moment that you won't be able to control. Do you kill yourself? Do you, like, what do you do? Do you believe it? Because there are moments in this movie when, you know, you are going right along with David for the ride, and you're like, well, maybe this all didn't happen. Maybe he is going crazy. You know,
because
we've gone 20 minutes now without seeing a werewolf. Like, there was a thing at the beginning, and now we haven't seen a werewolf for this long.
And I think that's part of the teaser too, because is it clear that it's a wolf that's attacking, you know, David and Jack out on the moors? I mean, we certainly hear the sound, and if you listen to it in a great mix, it actually moves around the room with you. But we just see a bunch of fur, and then we see something, and then the town folk show up and kill it, and then we see just a body.
Right.
And so when we're presented by the police and the head doctor that are just like, oh, they said it was a crazy man.
Escape lunatic,
which is another great trope in horror movies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We do run on that chase of, is he just going psychotic? Is he just having a post-traumatic stress breakdown? Is he just imagining all this?
Don't help that because he's having constant nightmares.
And, you know, he does not turn into the wolf until the last third of the movie, last quarter of the movie.
Yeah. Right.
But when he does, this is my first real visceral memory. First time I ever remember the body horror, the someone being so viciously twisted and turned into something other. I honestly can't stand it when Rodrigo in one of our other podcasts refers to the people who have the heads that are melted candles. Cannot stand that. I hate that concept. I hate that image. The only thing worse is the other crap that he says immediately after that. And seeing the transformation, you know, and makeup aside, seeing that transformation and taking it at its, you know, just the bare bones expectation. This is one of the first time I was terrified enough to where I couldn't watch anymore. I'm maybe 13, 14 years old when I first saw this movie. And we get to the point where the fingers are twisting and we're done.
So we're out. In the original werewolf movie, Universal's Werewolf, and that was, I think, Lon Chaney Jr., you know, you see this thing where the moon comes out from behind the clouds and Lon Chaney reacts and you see his eyes open up wide. And you start to see his hands kind of twitch. And then you cut to his eyes with a light slashing across the face. And then you go into this really weird makeup. And this is how they had to apply the makeup in the original werewolf movie is, okay, Lon Chaney, hold your hand really still. And we're going to apply a little patch of fur. And we're going to take a picture of that. And we're going to apply another patch of fur over here. And it's going to gradually, we're going to fill up your whole hand with werewolf fur, and we're going to do kind of a fade, a cross dissolve between all these different shots to make it look like it's built up.
Werewolf transformation, a love letter to the cross dissolve.
Yes, and the same way when they do his face. I mean, he's sitting there in the makeup, and they're just layering it on, layering it on, and it looks really, really bad as far as a transformation. So if you're going to redo a werewolf movie, and I'm trying to think if there were any other, I mean...
Well, there's
the
Howling.
Sure, yeah, the Howling, and I'm a Teenage Werewolf, and those kinds of things where you try to... Teen Wolf would have been after this, as far as it goes. You don't get into any kind of change in how we turn someone into a werewolf, right? Here we introduce Rick Baker, who takes a different take on how do we work with prosthetics? How do we work to make this change? How do we use robotics? And suddenly you're using air bladders and you're using robotic arms and you're using prosthetics that are using a different kind of rubber and latex than what has been before. And suddenly you've got a face, even though it does look relatively fake and stiff, you've got somebody screaming with his mouth open and all of a sudden the snout protrudes out of the front of the mouth and it looks incredibly believable. Mm-hmm. And we see the fingernails coming out of these paws in real time. We're not looking at stuff that's stop motion.
Hair growing out of the skin.
This is all stuff I'm wondering if that was done in reverse, where you've got the something underneath where you're pulling the hair in.
Some of it,
and you play it backwards so that it's crawling out.
Yeah, I think some of it was. I think that scene holds up.
This movie
was made in 1981.
Yeah.
And it holds up way better than a lot of stuff that came later.
When it starts in, they're showing his arm transform. I think that was. It looked to me like it was CG or kind of.
There was no CG. This is all real.
Okay, well then the arm thing was probably the one that there was the first one, and it kind of didn't feel like good. But then after it got past that, I was like, it was hard to watch.
This is
horrible.
1981, Zach. The C's were as big as a room, and they didn't G very well.
The thing that I kept expecting watching this, you know, I expect the back legs at least to do a and bend the other way, and they don't do that in this movie, which was really surprising. But
they didn't shatter the stuntman's legs.
Yeah. But
come on, Griffin Dunn. Wait, is it Griffin Dunn? Is that the guy's name?
Griffin Dunn was.
That's Jack.
The dead guy.
Mm. Right.
Yeah. David Naughton.
Right. Come on, David.
Take one for the team.
Come on, you have to suffer for your art.
Let's see you be a Pepper now.
But really, that whole transformation, most of it is just prosthetics done. I've got a set effects magazine of this.
Well, and if you get the DVD, the special features talk about
it. Oh,
it's
on there, yeah.
I mean, you would be surprised how much of it was basically done with condoms.
Yeah. Right? That's the whole thing.
I actually would.
Let's put a bladder condom. Right. You know, let's put that down and lay it flat and run a little air hose. Cover it with liquid latex and fur. And then as we just simply stand out of frame and blow into it, suddenly your back starts to bubble up and convulse. Yeah. I mean, this is when we talked about gremlins. And we talked about the gremlin growing in size. The fur is just a balloon and people pumping it up. This is what, I mean, the facial stuff, bubbling and moving, all this stuff. Wow. This is what got people to notice about special effects and what you could do with special effects makeup. This is what earned Rick Baker an Oscar for special effects, is this transformation what's his name, David, into a werewolf. And again, I keep going back because it's just so funny, you know, the Nazi werewolves, which are almost, let's take the molds of the four or five different transformation shots and apply them each onto a different guy as a Nazi. Because if you look, it's almost the same mold that's being used there, and just have him come in and slaughter his family left and right. So nice. Germans.
Germans.
So do you think from watching this, and I don't know how many horror movies you watch, because you said you don't like to be scared.
I've watched a dozen of them.
Do you think that you have grasped what it takes to horrify people? I mean, and I guess this is, I don't know, I guess I have an appreciation for people like the Ridley Scotts and whoever did the first Halloween movie.
What's his name?
John Carpenter.
Carpenter.
And especially Carpenter's The Thing. We look at this, American Werewolf in London by John Landis, and even some of the older ones where you have this ability to scare.
Clive Barker.
You have this ability to scare, and you can create some terrifying scenes, like someone's face actually not time-lapsed, having a snout grow out of the face, compared to... Well, someone's just standing there having normal conversation, and then a chainsaw bursts through his chest and rips him up, and blood and viscera is all over the place, and it's like, let's drill it in, you know, I think there's and again, that goes into that concept of what the torture porn is. I think that these are two very different types of horror that are not aligned anymore. Horror is not what it used to be, and I'm not sure I get what the thrill of seeing someone's mouth sewn to someone's anus, and that is a horror movie.
I think it is two different things. Mm-hmm. One of them is like when you think about the sort of horror of an American Werewolf in London, it's actually suspense.
Yeah. Right.
It's actually, you might think of it more as suspense than quote unquote horror because, what movies like definitely something like Resident Evil and things like that rely on is that start, right?
Right.
Is that all of a sudden you are startled.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's that jump, which actually an American Werewolf in London does very little of. And then the other ones are actually just playing on your sensibilities. Stuff like Saw Once you are informed of what's going to happen, it gives you time to think about it and think about how horrendous it's going to be, and then it does it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not scary. It's gross. It's
right.
It's it harms you emotionally, and that's what it does.
Yeah.
And in a way, all three of those things accomplish the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
They all give you a feeling of intense discomfort, and yes. then once it's over, you get to have that rush of like, well, it was only a movie or whatever.
Right.
And when you get into like a movie like your Saw, and honestly, of the torture porn genre, as strange as this sounds, Saw is kind of on the high end of the concept.
Well, I think the first one was.
The first one was.
I think it devolved very quickly after that.
I'm speaking of Saw.
Yeah.
The movie Saw in whatever year that came out. But when you get right down to it, to some degree, by the time you're into that fourth and fifth movie, or, you know, I always use the example of when I watched House of 1,000 Corpses. It was partly how far will they go? But my mind was also, how are they going to do it? Can they do what they're threatening to do? And with the Saw movies and with, you know, the Human Centipede and the movies that are all about extreme torture and maiming and horrifying things happening to essentially innocent people, what it really comes down to is kind of a question of, are they going to go there? Because if I look at, you know, there's a point in one of the Saw movies where a guy gets stabbed in the back with these needles that are injecting acid, and then he melts in half, and as he's dying, his lower body falls to the ground. And my mind is sitting there and going, that was probably scary in theaters, but right now I'm trying to think how they pulled it off in terms of the actual physical, because it's the guy there, and it's not like CG or anything. It's a physical body or a model. I think to some degree, when you get into it, it's I don't want to argue desensitization, but it gets to a point where you've seen people stabbed and chased by, you know, men with chainsaws and, you know, hit by cars that burst into flame, whatever it is. This is the deeper, the more realistic is probably the wrong word, but the more clear representation of different types of horrible things happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you're building upon that theme. So
in like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was that way.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That first Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie, I saw that in a drive-in when I was 16 years old, and it was so terrifying that a girl that I hated and I dated for 4 months afterward, because we were locked in the car together watching that terrible movie. And, you know, you lock that terrible movie and you just grab a hold of whatever you can, and it turned out to be me, and that was awesome. But when it gets down to it, I think right now some of it is, can we show in a quote-unquote realistic manner someone having their, you know, their head chopped off or their brain cut open or their arm lopped off and used to beat them to death, whatever you want to do. Can you do it in a way that looks more realistic than what, you know, we grew up with the rubber implements and the mm-hmm. stuff? And if you look at this movie is terrifying now 30 years later on that same level. But I think because of what happened in this movie, to some degree, is why we have that torture porn genre.
Absolutely.
That,
I mean, people looked at this movie and said, look at what we can accomplish with special effects.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas really when this movie went in was, here are the problems that we need to solve. And the reason why the special effects are so good is because they had things that they wanted to show and they had to innovate in order to do them.
Mm-hmm.
It's Star Wars in a way, you know. Part of the reason why Star Wars was so great and their special effects were so great, they were like, how the hell are we going to do this, guys?
Yeah.
And it was just a bunch of guys like sitting around and being like, what if one of the Star Destroyers is a shoe? All right, let's do that.
Yeah. I don't know, is there innovation in horror now? Have we gotten to the point where we are able to do anything we want at a whim, that we no longer have to innovate in telling some of these stories?
There can be to a certain degree. Like I think if you look at something like The Ring, which, you know, maybe doesn't do anything specifically original in its tropes, but takes modern trappings and scares us with them. Which is actually, again, kind of what this movie does. I mean, it takes a werewolf and puts it in a very straightforward, realistic way. You know, he's not chasing people through a forest.
Right.
He's running around Piccadilly Circus. Mm-hmm.
I think you look at the innovation that probably maybe most recently in horror movie is still over a decade old was like the found footage movies.
Yeah. Right.
Those are recently new. Yeah, and so, I mean, and now those are getting slightly played out or whatever. But I mean, that was the innovation. It's not the innovation of... I mean, like what they're showing on TV screen, but it's like the manner of how we, I guess, the show the story.
The technique using to deliver the scare. If you look at, say, the kid and I watched Paranormal Activity, there are five really terrifying moments in that film. But they build it and they build it and they build it. And I think the film is successful because of the technique they use to build it. I mean, if you look at, say, 15 years ago, the movie, the remake of House on Haunted Hill with Jean Grey and Jeffrey Rush and Tyrese Gibson and those guys,
mm-hmm.
Taye Diggs, rather. I really like that movie, and I find it really terrifying and really effective because of the way they vary their themes. I mean, in the year 2013, I think that there's two problems with saying, is there innovation? First, you know, the movie industry is 100 years old. There aren't really any stories that somebody hasn't tried to tell at this point. It's what are you going to do? How are you going to do it? Is it a question of technique? Is it a question of form? Is it a question of perspective? How are you going to make this your story? But more importantly, people are still being scared by movies. When we rented The House in the Woods, The Cabin in the Woods. Cabin in the Woods is a very metatextual film that says, okay, we know what you expect from a horror movie. We're going to show you everything you expect, and then we're going to say, ha-ha, everything you expect is not what you expect. I feel like that is a real, for some values of the word, innovation of the horror form, because it's flat out saying we know what you expect. Well, we know what you think you're going to see.
In a way.
So we're going to address that.
In a way it is. And in a way, it's doing the exact same thing that An American Werewolf in London does and that Shaun of the Dead does. Is you take the tropes of the horror movie and you basically you are walking down this path, and each time you encounter a trope, it either plays it straight and scares you or flips it and makes you laugh at it.
Right.
And you never know each time you get somewhere whether you're going to laugh or be scared. And that's what the movie does every time, is when you expect, like, you're like, okay, this time they're going to scare me, and they make you laugh. Mm. And you laugh so hard because you were expecting to be scared. Mm. And likewise, they get to a point and you're like, oh, they're going to make fun of this one, and it's the scariest thing in the universe because once again, you weren't expecting it.
Have you guys ever watched Funny Games? It was made by a German director, and then he did a Shock for Shock remake in English. And I know it plays a lot of horror tropes in that it gets you right up to that moment, and it makes you believe, and it'll do the scene, but not how most horror movies would do it. They'll still do exactly what you think, and then it plays with some other things at the end. It's really interesting and worth watching, I think, if you see it.
Rodrigo, why is American Werewolf in London one of your favorite all-time movies?
I think it's because it does that. I think it's because it actually goes into very familiar territory and then picks and chooses the things that it likes about it, keeps those, and then does new and different things with the others. And you know, along with that, it's got great special effects. And I actually think that it's a very good werewolf movie. I think that there's a core, just like the zombie, and like, I think the core of the zombie movie is people are going to kill you.
Yes.
Not necessarily zombies are going to kill you, but either people or zombies are going to kill you.
Right.
I think the core of the werewolf movie is a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
The protagonist is doomed from the beginning, and then you see him Hamlet his way through it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what a werewolf movie is. And I think, you know, American Werewolf in London, The Howling, actually, Ginger Snaps, I think those are all examples of, like, really good werewolf movies that keep that core of what's a good werewolf movie, and then essentially play with the themes around it.
Yeah. So one of the, I guess, interesting things about how we all watch this is if you've had this on DVD for years.
Yeah.
I watched this from a Blu-ray version in the home theater. Zach watched this on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different experiences that go into, and Matthew may have seen this. He said he saw this at a drive-in.
VHS.
There are a number of things that happen in this viewing experience. And one of the things that are gained or lost in film, and we're going to talk about that right after we thank some people.
Yeah, let's thank some people. I'd like to shout out to Aaron Lim, Benjamin Wisher, Vern Wells, Andrew Coleman, Sean Krause, Roberto Lawson, Joel A. Maroney, Kevin Hall, The Mongoon Show, and Andrew Irwin. Thank you for your donations to Major Spoilers and helping to keep this cause alive and going week after week.
If you want to find out more and how you can get your name shouted out at this part of the show, head over to members.majorspoilers.com. So, Zach, you didn't have a very good experience watching this movie, beyond the fact that you were scared and your fiance had to hold you tight and say, there, young Zach.
Yeah, she comforted me through this.
She told you to shut up, didn't she?
No, she was building some Halloween costume. Yeah, she smacked me.
She was making a sexy werewolf costume. Is that what you said?
She was making a scarecrow costume for the kindergarten class she teaches.
Oh, well, sexy werewolf would have totally been inappropriate then.
Yeah. No.
So totally anyway, what happened?
So I'm watching it and I'm streaming
it. You're watching this on your computer.
I started watching the movie on my fiance's laptop, streaming from Amazon Prime. And so I watch it, and it gets to some scenes where the two friends are talking after one's dead and one's kind of going psycho, and it's just so dark, I can't even see one of the characters. I was like, surely this isn't lighting. I understand it's dark, it's night, they're indoors, but you don't shoot a film like this. You don't shoot things like this where you can't see an entire character for an entire conversation. So I stopped watching on our laptop. I said, something's wrong with your internet. Something's wrong with your computer. I'll go home. I'll watch it on my iMac. Surely it'll be better. Fast forward, it wasn't. It was completely dark. Get to the end scene with the movie theater, and we're seeing all the people. David's killed, and I'm still completely not being able to see characters on the screen due to how dark it was. And I had my brightness fully jacked up. My stream was fine. It was just the film was way too dark.
So actually, what Amazon Prime is doing is it's doing it exactly correct in that it is taking something that has what is called a very large latitude or a high contrast range, and it's compressing it down into a format that it can deliver easily and stream easily over the web. When we talk about contrast range or we talk about latitude, we're talking about all the different variations from pure black to pure white that a medium is able to reproduce. Film has a huge latitude. This is why a lot of people like to shoot on film, and why you may want to shoot on film, Zach, is because you can go way far into the blacks without it being crushed, without it totally losing detail. So you are sitting on a black couch. You have your black backpack there. You've got your black Jack gum, and you're wearing your black jacket, right? Rodrigo and I sitting here can see and make out all the details of the couch. We can see where the backpack transitions into the couch. We can make out the variations and the wrinkles and how the light hits that backpack. Our eyes have a huge latitude, okay? Right. And so we can make out all of these details. Film can do that too. It can see the shadow that your black backpack is casting onto the black couch, and it can reproduce that. Video, on the other hand, does not have as wide a latitude or as wide a contrast range. It's not able to produce all of the variations in that color or shading. So when you start to get too dark or when you start to get too light, you either run into the mud, you crush your blacks, meaning that the transition zone between your backpack and the couch where that shadow is would be all one single color to video, whereas film would be able to see that separation. And
we should point out that it does depend on the type of film.
It does depend on the type of film.
But film in general has wider, is a more forgiving medium when it comes to your blacks.
And you can also use that to great effectiveness when you're doing special effects. Because it has such a wide latitude and it is so forgiving, you can let a lot of stuff slip through. When you start crushing that stuff, when you start smashing it together and trying to make it smaller to fit into this different format. And by smaller, I'm not actually saying we're reducing the image size or anything like that.
But you're reducing the information.
Yes, you're reducing
each
information.
Individual
and there,
pixel.
And there is information loss. So when you watch, and this just saddened me to no end, when I got that VHS collection of the original Star Wars movies in the widescreen, and the TIE fighters come flying through, I'm like, what the hell's that white box all the way around?
You can see the mat.
That's the mat that in video pops out because the contrast range is reduced. Huh. It's almost like adjusting the contrast on your TV.
Yeah.
Whereas in film, it's so spread out, you don't notice that transition zone as much. So in the case of Star Wars and even Star Trek, a lot of the special effects are ruined in the original version because of the mats are all messy. Of course, when Lucas, you know, when they did the 20-year and the 30-year anniversary and they remastered everything digitally, they went in and cleaned all that stuff up.
And the 23-year and the 28-year.
And the 21-year and 6-month. Mm-hmm. They cleaned all that up, and they, of course, they replaced it a lot with digital, so you don't see that anymore. So we don't have that record as much anymore of what happens. But when we're taking a video or a film and we're crushing it down even smaller to a web space, we're losing even more contrast. And this is why when you're watching a film, and you can see this too on your YouTube videos, if you look closely, blow it up and you will actually see chunks of the pixelization going on because it's trying to compress or quantize that information in those specific regions. So you get very blocky stuff. And especially you see this, dig on the company that you work for, but they do digital broadcasts, right?
Yeah.
And so some on sometimes on the lower channels, when they're doing a gradient fade where it starts dark in one corner and then moves across, you actually see the blocks
move across the
screen.
It's like a pixelated blob trying to eat your TV.
Super annoying.
And that is just the nature of compressing that data down even smaller and losing even more contrast range and losing even more information. So unfortunately, what's happening is you're taking something that was shot intentionally on film to have a wide latitude so that you could see the little details of the hairs sprouting out the back of his neck, so that you could see the gray fur of David in the theater as he's leaning over that very dark, bloodied body and looking up at the usher or whoever the man was who's dark-skinned and wearing dark clothes. Mm-hmm. In the film, you can see all of that. Crunch that down for a streaming experience. And I'm going to bet that this was not a 1080p streaming experience.
No.
This was probably a 680 streaming experience.
Yeah, probably.
You're losing a ton of information, and suddenly the real cool transformation of Jack, right? That's the friend's name.
Yeah.
From fresh zombie to rotted zombie, where his teeth are showing and his eyes are just rolling around in the sockets. All of that's completely lost because of the digital format. So when we look at cameras, and I know you and I are kind of both up on cameras and get giddy over the experience of what the camera can reproduce. This is why so many people are excited about 10-bit cameras and cameras like the Blackmagic camera, these cameras that can shoot in RAW, because what they're trying to do is move away from an 8-bit environment, which is traditional video, into a 10-bit or even larger color range that will give you that latitude. And if you've seen that Blackmagic stuff, you see that it looks very flat because it's capturing those highs and those lows and allows you then to go into post and adjust that so that you can get the contrast that you want out of your picture and to colorize it without losing that information. Unfortunately, until you're using a camera that has a large color range or has a large contrast range or latitude, you have to be very careful about what you're shooting because you're going to lose a lot of stuff in your blacks and you're going to lose a lot of stuff in your whites, and you're not going to be able to recover any of that. Mm-hmm.
Additionally, this does bring up something important that you have to learn as a person who produces media, especially visual media, is you are going to have to come to terms, and this might be easier for you. For some people, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
You're going to have to come to terms with the fact that there are going to be people who experience your work who are going to do it on crappy TVs or streaming it at the lowest stream possible. Mm-hmm. And this magnificent masterpiece that you made is going to look crappy through no fault of your own. It's just the way that they're experiencing it is going to suck. And you have to, like, I don't know, bite your knuckle and just realize that that's the way that things are going to be sometimes.
One of the cool things about the Moore sequence or when they're walking out, at least in the version that I watched, and my home theater's got surround sound and all that in there. as the werewolf is howling, you hear it on the different parts of the screen where it's supposed to be in that aural space. And that's really cool if you've got a surround sound mix. But the other thing is, as Rodrigo was saying, you have to think about the least common denominator. So what ends up happening a lot of times when you go into an edit bay is, yeah, they may have some really cool speakers, but right next to it somewhere, they're going to have what's called a granny speaker.
Right.
Yeah. The kind of speaker that your grandma is going to have in her crappy 1975 Zenith, and they're going to listen to it through that, and they're going to watch it on a lower quality monitor so that they can see, well, what's it going to look like when it hits the end user? What's going to when it hits the person who hasn't gone through the HD conversion yet? What's going to happen to someone who doesn't have a surround sound into their TV? What's it going to sound like?
I mean, this happened to me
a lot on PBS, right?
This happened to me, like, this literally happened to me like a month ago, where I was sitting there, I was editing something, and the audio mix in my headphones sounded just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But when you put it out, and somebody has like a single speaker TV, not even like not even mono on two channels, just like a just TV a that only has one, like, or somebody's watching it on their computer with crappy speakers, or like the music was too loud, and I was like, you don't tell me that the music was too loud. The music was perfect.
Well,
but when somebody else heard it, it just compressed everything, so the music was too loud.
A good example of that is, well, you weren't here for Dungeons and Dragons, but when we do bonus tracks, the way we have it hooked up, and I'm going to have to check and see about trying to get a mono only out, but that happens when we're watching the movie, is we feed a line in so that we can hear it while we're talking, and what ends up happening is we lose the dialogue and we hear the music because of the way things are mixed coming through that single channel. So this happens a lot, and you really do have to be aware of it. I mean, you may come up with something that looks fantastic, but the minute it shows up on YouTube, man, it looks like a cruddy mess.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that always happens, because you can upload stuff at 1080p and it looks fantastic. Yeah. I mean, look at that stuff GoPro is doing. But maybe you're going to put it on a local cable channel and they're going to only run it at SD. You shake your head and you shudder.
Oh, I deal with it all the time. Oh, it drives me up the wall.
Believe me, the stuff that we're
SD?
Doing.
No, you can't. It's 2013.
The stuff we're doing, you know, the problem with the college channel is it's still SD. So we're shooting all of these football games and everything in HD, and it just looks wonderful and it looks perfect. And it's like, oh, when this shows on an HD channel, it's going to be wonderful. And then you flip it onto the on-demand, or you flip it onto just the regular over-the-air broadcast, and it's the colors are all muddy, they're bleeding across one another and all these things. And it's the nature of the medium. You know, 15 years ago, we would have accepted that gladly. We would have said, oh, this looks wonderful. Today, we look at it and say, it's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So
it's kind of like in our cable packages now, you have generally more channels in your SD package, but our TV never, our cable guide never goes to the SD. We just keep it in our HD thing. I'm not going to watch anything in SD anymore.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. he's become a snob.
No, that's fine.
Well, he was, you know, Zach was fairly young when the transition happened.
Yeah.
Exactly.
He doesn't remember the days of yore.
Well, and that's you know, when we talk, we could go into a whole discussion of how the government screwed over HD and how we could have had true HD back in the 80s. But regulation got into it, and government...
We could have had free electricity if Tesla had only been allowed.
I know, stupid Edison.
Edison.
That hack. You know, he was one of the first pirates of movies, of media. He stole George Millais' trip to the moon
and made copies of it. Let's not bash on Edison.
We have to bash on Edison every chance we get.
Because we start here, and then all of a sudden we're talking about bacon and uploading pictures of laughing frickin' cats, and no... here is where I draw.
Oh, wait, hold on. I don't understand. What's wrong with bacon and laughing cats?
Nothing.
I will kill you.
So, yes, understand. Edison bad, Tesla good.
Yeah.
No.
Except for the whole, like, eugenics thing.
Life is more complex than that. There are no heroes and villains.
Except for Edison.
And
he's
Batman.
He's a villain. And Batman, yes.
Okay.
So, Zach, what have you learned about horror? Or other things that you may have picked up while watching An American Werewolf in London.
Because I was watching
One thing that I've learned is apparently a wolf can bite a man's head off in one pass.
Well, a werewolf certainly can.
Head goes rolling across the street.
Ate, like, 9 kids.
That was probably one of the best moments of these cars just smashing into one another. You can tell John Landis is maybe making references back to National Lampoon at the end. Animal House. Everything is just blowing
well,
up.
Well, I mean, that scene is to a large degree what we wanted, right? It's like this whole movie just like builds, like just has this slow burn all the way up there, and then it's like everything, every last thing, this werewolf destroys the world in front of you.
Yes, yes. Awesome. In 5 seconds.
In 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So what'd you learn, Zach?
So I was watching American Werewolf in London, and I was thinking, What does it take to make up a mashup genre movie good? And so I pondered this while people died on the screen. And I thought, well, John Landis, he's a pretty funny guy. And this movie's pretty funny. I don't know what his pedigree on horror movies before this. But so I was thinking, and then I thought, in my room I have a poster of Red State. I said, well, Kevin Smith is a funny guy, but he made Red State. That's a pretty freaking scary movie. But there's very Kevin Smith-like elements of just a plethora of dialogue running through this movie. So I figured maybe the way to make a successful genre smash-up movie is understand what your strengths are. And I think Landis found that with his comedy, and Kevin Smith certainly found it with his writing style. And then to bring in a team that can complement your style to make the movie you want to make. I mean, because we talk about John Landis or Ridley Scott or Christopher Nolan as the people that are making this movie, but really there's hundreds of thousands of people making this movie.
Right.
So ability to bring in a good team has to be important in making anything, but I think especially possibly a genre mashup.
And well, that's a great point for any movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, the director is obviously incredibly important because they're the ones in control, unless you count like an executive producer or something like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously having a director of photography who understands what you're going for, a gaffer who understands what you're going for, a special effects team who understands what you're going for, that's what synthesizes into a good movie, at least visually, and is as you pointed out, particularly vital in a movie that is maybe floating in between genres when you need to. You can't just say, okay, make this set scary. You have to be like, for a movie in which the characters are going to be joking around before one of them gets their head eaten, how do we light this?
Right.
What did your girlfriend think?
I'm too busy making Scarecrow costumes for little kids.
Well, I had it playing. I watched probably the first 40 minutes with her in the room, and it was tilted, and she was watching it and she was commenting and things, and then I saw her later in the day when I had finished the movie. I was like, wow, I'm glad you didn't finish watching that movie with me, because you would have left, because that transformation scene was horribly terrifying and I had trouble watching it. There's no way you would have made it through. So she did not.
You should really borrow Rodrigo's Blu-ray. And,
mine's a DVD. I actually got it before I had a...
Oh, before you had a Blu-ray player.
Yeah, actually, I really enjoyed this movie, so I might just pick it up.
Yeah. And how are you going to pick that up, Zach?
Oh, I'd probably just head over to majorspoilers.com and click on an Amazon.com link. It's what I would do.
Being rational. Same price to buy the Blu-ray?
Oh, I would assume it'd probably be the same price. Actually, I know it would be the same price, but a little bit would come back to Major Spoilers to help us out.
Excellent. Yeah. Zach, I think you got a good grasp of what horror is. I think you know what scares you, right?
Yeah.
And do you have a good grasp of what do you think scares other people?
I think so.
I think it's pretty easy to take that and wrap it around a story and do something. So good job.
Right. Thank you.
I think you did a great job. And since you said you liked the movie, then...
You have to deduct a little bit because he didn't say he loved the movie.
Yes.
But he didn't say he was going to buy it using that Amazon.com link over at majorspoilers.com.
That's right. No, of course you would have been perfectly fine had you not liked it. But I'm glad that you did get out of it basically what I did.
Yeah. Matthew?
C+. Nah, I'm being a dick. Probably an A-. Zach definitely has an understanding of what makes the movie work and what makes the movie scary. So I'll give him props this week.
All right, cool.
Thank you. Well, that'll do it for us this week.
Oh, wait a minute.
Whoa.
What are we doing next week?
Next week, there will not be a Zach on Film.
Why not?
Audio podcast. Well, I have this job, and right now, at the time of this recording, it is football postseason, baby. Whoop, whoop, go sports, go. And next week, when we generally record all these fine podcasts you listen to, I will be in the middle of a show in the studio, giving some highlights of all the great high school playoff football action that's happening that week.
Cool.
So I will not be here.
So what are we going to do instead?
Well, I think if you kind of keep your eye on majorspoilers.com, you might see some video content.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, instead of just audio, let's go video and audio next week.
And it has to do with, Saul comes about based on a question that someone sent into our other podcast,
I think it was,
Major Spoilers Podcast, mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens and
how well
it comes out. Yeah. Have you already done it?
I haven't yet.
Okay.
I've been busy.
Wait until it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. Wait until the witching hour and then watch that movie.
The witching hour. My clock doesn't go that high. Well, that's it. Next week, video stuff. The week after that, if you want to get ready, we'll be watching Memento. So watch that. That's it for this week on Zach on Film.